This is The End User, episode 125 for Tuesday, February 26. Chromebook UltraPixel Infinity. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I am Futurist Prime, Taylor Mon.
We've got quite a bit of news this week to get through. It feels good to get an event going in Mobile World Congress and get some news about new phones and new tablets and all kinds of stuff this week.
If only we could be there live covering it from Barcelona.
Yeah, wouldn't that be nice? I forget the conference. I just want to go to Barcelona.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, so oddly enough, our first story is not from MWC. It's that Google has confusingly released a new Chromebook, and it looks fantastic, by the way. It's called the Chromebook Pixel.
Why is it called the Pixel, Chris?
Because it has a very high-resolution screen.
How high resolution? Like, can you not see the pixels?
It should be called the non-pixel, right?
Right, the pixel-less.
Pixel-less. The device looks fantastic. I mean, the hardware looks great. It's a little bit weird that their screen is 3.2. I know we've had this conversation before. It's not a widescreen device.
So it's like the same aspect ratio as the original iPhone.
Right, right. So it's a little more...
But with a much higher resolution, I'm guessing. What's the resolution on this thing?
It's 239 pixels per inch.
So it's 2,560 pixels by 1,700 pixels.
That's quite even more high res than the MacBook Retina, isn't it?
It is more high res than... It's lower resolution than the 15-inch MacBook with Retina display, but higher resolution than the 13-inch.
Right, there we go. So it's pretty impressive. Looking at the hardware, it looks like a nice device, although... I can't imagine using Chrome OS for getting a much done. I mean, it's one thing to make one of these throwaway devices where you can get it for, let's say, under $500 or something like that, but this thing is $1,200.
Books up until now, they weren't aimed at being your main computer. You know, you'd buy it and you'd have everything in the cloud and you didn't have to worry too much about the computer. But for $1,300, you want this thing to be able to do everything any other $1,300 computer would do. And it's just hard to imagine that being possible. Although they want to believe that it is. And that's why they gave it such a great screen and put three microphones in it. One for listening, one for noise canceling, and one for keyboard click canceling.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think I can see the dream, right? I can see what they were after in creating this, but I just don't think it translates into reality. And, you know, do you think this is more of like a reference device, kind of like the Nexus phones?
I think so. I'm not sure what it's for. I don't even understand the motivations for making this. It just seems like they wanted to basically make a MacBook Pro with Retina display, but then take out all of the things that they thought were overkill. But by doing that, they ended up making it more expensive because they made all these custom components, like this crazy screen, like this triple microphone thing. I mean, they're bragging that almost everything in the Chromebook Pixel is custom made. It's not a commodity part, which makes it more expensive. And yet it's only got like a low power dual core i5 processor.
Yeah, Core i5. That's the usual Ultrabook style processor, I guess, right?
And only 32 gigabytes of memory, which it claims you won't even need.
Yeah, it's a little confusing. I understand what they were dreaming about, but I'm not sure that the software on it executes that dream. The hardware certainly does, but it's just a little confusing to me.
Well, we haven't seen it yet. The Wi-Fi only version will be available. I guess it's for sale now for $1,300, and they're going to release an LTE version in a few months for $1,450, and it's going to come with a bunch of free storage from Google Drive, as well as a couple of free trips of in-flight Wi-Fi.
Cool. Yeah. Well, that sounds pretty good. I mean. I'm still a bit confused by laptops that have LTE in it. I'm not sure why I would want that when I can use Wi-Fi. Adding a monthly bill doesn't seem to be consistent with what I would expect from a laptop. But I know there are a lot of people out there, road warriors and the like, that actually would love that.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's get into our second story. We have details about the PlayStation 4, and this is kind of
exciting.
We have
an idea when it's coming out.
Uh-huh.
We have no idea what it looks like. We don't know what the controllers look like.
Yeah, they previewed the new DualShock 4, and it has a touchscreen, and it has a little area underneath it that can be seen by the PS4 and placed in the room, kind of like a Kinect. What did they call it? The Move. And I think short of seeing the console and what it looks like, I guess we don't care what it looks like, right? But it looks pretty compelling, and it's Xbox Move now.
Is that really what you think of it? It's just Xbox Move?
No, it is currently the Xbox's turn to do something next generation.
Ah, I see. I thought you were comparing it to Kinect. No, but despite the fact that we haven't seen the console of the PS4 yet, I think it's really interesting. They are changing their development strategy. Remember, the PS3 had this crazy custom-designed 3-core cell processor.
Right.
And now they're going with AMD.
I like Yell processor. That should be a thing.
Maybe it should. Maybe for the PS5. But the whole point of doing this is to use closer to off-the-shelf components and make it easier for developers to make games. They came out with the PS3. It was the most powerful gaming system that had been invented at the time, and nobody could develop fast enough to make games that used all of its power. So hopefully this new tactic will make a cheaper platform and one that's easier to make games for.
Yeah, Josh Pollard and I from Entertainment 2.0 talked about this as I was a guest host last week. So if you'd like to hear a little bit more, you can go over there. But yeah, I think making the switch to the x86 architecture means that it's not compatible with any PS3 games. And I think that'll be fine in the long run. But man, it's going to hurt up front, isn't it?
Depends what the developers do. I mean, maybe they have some easy way to just transfer the compatibility over the games.
Yeah, particularly with games, I'm not sure it's going to work like that. If it were just some kind of like a phone app or something, they can be relatively independent. But I think the games are typically a little more dependent on the hardware that they're running on. But
well, I still think it makes sense. Nobody gave Apple too much trouble when they switched from PowerPC to Intel, and that's pretty much what the PS4 is trying to do here.
So another interesting bit is they're going to allow you to stream your game live over Ustream. So if you're playing a game, you can go live and have other people watch you play the game, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, that sounds like so much fun to go online and watch someone else play video games.
Hey, people do it all the time.
Well, not me.
I don't know. I can see a use case for that, and people do it a lot. And I think it's nice to see it baked right into the console. Most people who do that have software on their computer that they're using, like we are for the podcast, and they screen cap what they're playing and then broadcast it live. So it's kind of cool to have it baked right into the console.
Right. Well, we don't know exactly when the PS4 is going to be released. They're saying it's going to come out in the holidays for 2013, but they've more recently said that it will not be available worldwide in all markets for holiday 2013. So if you are already updating your holiday season shopping list, you may have to be prepared to get a gift certificate.
Yeah, I guess we'll find out as the time gets near. I'll be excited to see what it looks like, even though it doesn't matter a whole lot. I kind of like the industrial design of these things anyway.
Yeah, I wasn't crazy about the PlayStation 3 in any of its iterations. I think the curved top was weird. So I will be a bit interested to see what they do as well. In other words, don't screw it up.
Yeah, so we'll see how it does. This is the second of the next generation consoles. We have the Wii U out there, and we're still waiting on the Xbox. So I'm excited to see how this all pans out.
Right. All right. Well, like we mentioned, there was a big conference this week in Barcelona, Spain, the Mobile World Congress, and a lot of new phones came out, as well as tablets, and a couple of companies we haven't seen before came out with Android tablets and the like. So should we start talking about those?
Let's get right into it. So the first one we've got here is the Samsung Galaxy Note 8. They've made it official. They've got a new processor called the Exynos 4, and it's 1280 by 800, and it's got the Android Jelly Bean 4.1.2.
Yeah, they did an interesting thing here because the Galaxy Note 10.1 is also 1280 by 800. So they sort of did an iPad mini thing where they shrink it and give it the same resolution. And I'm not sure about that, but you know what? It looks like a pretty good tablet.
Yeah, it's like a... It's a huge device, isn't it?
What, an 8-inch screen with, looks like, a bezel maybe slightly larger than the iPad mini?
What I mean by that is they're kind of bridging the gap between the 10-inch devices and the 7-inch devices. I think we've kind of chosen those sizes because they make sense, and I'm not sure... maybe it doesn't matter, right?
Do you think it matters a lot. I think they could not make it more obvious that they are gunning for the iPad mini with this tablet.
So do you think this would be comfortable to read a book on, like 7-inch tablets are? Hard to say.
Yeah, probably. I mean, it's got better pixel density than most 7-inch tablets. It probably won't be that much heavier. Let's see, it weighs... I don't see the weight. I don't know how much it weighs.
Well, it could be, just not on there.
It might not be, but I'm sure it won't be any heavier than the iPad mini, especially since that one's made of metal and this one is made of plastic.
Right. And they've got the active capacitive pen going on that they have in all of the other Note lines that we've seen before. So if you're a fan of drawing on the display like with the other Notes, then you'll be happy. If you're not, then who cares? You can just leave the pen at home, I guess, right?
Or just get another tablet.
Yeah, or just get one that is agnostic to its input.
Right.
All right, so let's keep on moving. We've got another story about Android, oddly enough.
Yes, HP has decided to launch a 7-inch Android tablet called the Slate 7.
Wait, wasn't that a Windows 7 tablet previously?
Was it?
Was it really?
Well, I think it's interesting because they're calling this the Slate 7, so obviously they have some other sizes in mind. But this one is launching at only $170. It is a little bit underpowered compared to a lot of 7-inch tablets. It's got less power than the current Nexus 7 or the Kindle Fire HD. But the main features that HP is advertising is mainly the ability to print. So it should be able to natively print to any HP printer, as well as anything that has network printing built in.
Right, and this is Android Jelly Bean. It's got a 1.6 gigahertz chip, ARM Cortex A9, so that's kind of the last generation of processors. But yeah, I mean, if they can hit it at $170, I mean, that's kind of crazy.
It's pretty crazy. But I don't know. It's all going to be about the implementation, right? Somebody's got to take it apart, see how it works, make sure there's no lag, make sure it actually prints. And they will be able to do that in April.
Now, what I do appreciate is that they're using stock Android. They're not putting the skin over top. Like we talked about the Samsung Note previously, and they're going to have their TouchWiz UX, or as I like to say, TouchWizX, skin over top of Android. And I really think that is not necessary for anything. And it's much appreciated that they're using stock Android on this.
Right. Well, HP has had a lot of time to think about what kind of operating system they were going to put on their tablets. They came out with the touchpad, and that was running WebOS. And they were planning for a long time to use WebOS as the central piece of their tablet operating system. They bought it from Palm for a lot of money. But now it turns out, with the news of their new Android tablet, they went ahead and sold it to LG.
Yeah, and that's really kind of odd, isn't it? What's LG going to do with this? Are they going to release their own WebOS phones?
I guess they're going to just put it on televisions. That's their plan. They've already got enough operating systems for their phones. They're just going to use it for televisions. I don't see at all how WebOS in any of its incarnations transfers to a television, but I guess that's up to LG now.
Well, I mean, you got to imagine that they've got the operating system bits. I mean, forget the UI for just a second. And maybe they can use some of the operating system bits and then skin the UI over in a way that makes sense for televisions. But yeah.
Maybe they could. But to me, the only thing that was really impressive about WebOS was the UI.
Yeah, I guess that's true. They had a kind of interesting development picture where you could develop in HTML5 and JavaScript and make these kind of web apps, as the name WebOS implies. And I wonder maybe if they're going to take some of the developer tools along with it or something like that. I don't know. It's very confusing, isn't it?
It is very confusing. But Palm OS, you know, it started with the Palm Pilot, it turned into WebOS. They made some smartphones. They sold it to HP. HP held on to it for a while, and now maybe someday we'll see it in televisions. I don't know. It's a very strange story for WebOS.
Yeah, very odd, but I guess we'll see what happens as time goes by. If this were the base for some kind of new smart TV platform that they were doing, I think they might be headed in an interesting direction, but they're going to have to customize it a whole ton.
Yeah, they certainly will. Like I said, I can't imagine how the UI would transfer to a TV at all. They're going to have to redo the whole thing. But anyway, in other news, another company has decided to get into the Android tablet game, and that's Lenovo. They are just jumping in with three new Android tablets. So they've got the S6000 10-inch tablet, the A3000 7-inch tablet, and the A1000, along with a K900 Android phone.
Right, so we had seen details about the Android phone before. I'm not sure if we talked about it on this podcast before, but I've definitely seen that thing around. And but the tablets are what is all new. And one of them is a 10-inch, and the other two are 7 inches. So they've got two 7-inch devices, one of which is a little lower end. So they've basically got the high end 10-inch device, a mid tier 7-inch device, and a cheap low end 7-inch device.
Yeah, one thing that I noticed about this is that they're all going to have Dolby Digital Plus audio. So that might sound good, or it might just be a joke.
You know, I've seen a video of this, the Dolby mobile version that they're pushing with mobile speakers that enhances the sound specifically for a mobile context. And it actually does help a lot. It still sounds tinny and awful because, you know, the speaker's just so small. There's not much you can do about that. But it does help a lot with the listenability of the audio, particularly on movies. It really kind of brings out the dialogue and makes it more listenable, I guess. So it's not worthless, but it's not worth a whole lot either, I think.
Okay. Well, is it worth more than Beats Audio?
It's probably worth more than Beats Audio, I'd say.
There we go.
So let's move into some more Mobile World Congress news. Asus has announced their new pad phone. This thing looks absolutely insane. What are you thinking?
I think it looks absolutely insane. I don't even know where to begin describing it. The pad phone Infinity, isn't it?
Yes, that's correct. We had seen some, they've been after this same goal for a while now, where you have a tablet and you put the phone into the back of the tablet. And
right, they started that with the Motorola something or other.
The what was that? The Atrix?
Yeah, the Atrix.
Yeah, so I guess that wasn't Asus, but yeah, they had the Atrix had a docking tablet that you could use.
No, it was a whole laptop.
Yeah, and it had a keyboard and everything.
Right. No, but this is pretty wild. I mean, you just slide the phone right into the back of the tablet.
Yeah, so you kind of have to go into the show notes and follow the link to get an idea of what we're talking about. But this thing is, it's kind of beautiful in a weird way. You've got this brushed aluminum metal phone that slides into the back of a, I think that's also aluminum. And it's just kind of weird, though. I mean, why do I need to dock a phone into a tablet? That the whole idea of that doesn't really make sense to me.
Well, I'm assuming it has to do with making sure all of the information that you want is synced because you don't trust the cloud to do it. But I thought that was the whole point of Android in the first place. Was
yeah, exactly.
The cloud would sync everything for you.
I mean, we live in a world where we can sync this information around. We don't really need to actually put the phone into the tablet.
But apparently we do, Chris. I don't know. Maybe it charges the phone. That'd be nice.
I don't know. There's no word of that in this article, at very least. So we'll have to kind of find out if that's the case or not. I'd have to imagine it is.
Right. Now, the craziest thing here is that the phone, the 5-inch screen, is 1080p. It's another one of these over 400 pixels per inch phones.
Yeah, 441 pixels per inch. So I wonder at what, I'd have to do some math here, but at what distance does this become Retina?
Okay, but then get this. So the tablet, the pad phone station, is only a little bit more than 1080p. It's only 1920 by 1200 instead of 1080. So they have almost exactly the same resolution. And one of them is 5 inches and the other one is 10 inches.
Yeah, it's a full 10 inches. Yeah, so that's a little bizarre. You think they could have upped that a little bit?
You would think, but they didn't. Maybe the Asus Padfone Infinity 2.
Yeah, so we're not going to, it's likely that we're not going to get this in the United States, but it will be available in Europe for 999 euros.
For the phone with the tablet.
Right. So, you know, we'll never see this, but it looks nice. I guess we can appreciate it from afar. I am kind of excited about Asus stepping into this. They don't have a ton of experience in the mobile handset business right now, and I'm excited to see them trying things, at very least.
Yeah, me too. But you know who I'm more excited about trying things?
Who's that?
HTC.
Yeah, they've really, I think they're starting to really come together, aren't they?
Yeah, so they released their new flagship phone, and they're calling it the HTC One. It is also going to have a 5-inch 1080p display. 4.7. So it'll be even higher resolution than the 441 of the Padfone Infinity or the Droid DNA. And they have a new camera that they're calling UltraPixel. Now, Chris, do you understand what UltraPixel is? Because I don't.
Let's be clear about this, Taylor. Nobody has any idea what they mean by UltraPixel.
Okay, good.
No, I mean, that's just their marketing wrapper that they're putting around the technology that they put into the camera. And it's not even that high resolution, actually. They've did a lot of work to get to try and get better information out of the pixels that they do have in the camera. In fact, not unlike what was talked about when the iPhone got the 5-megapixel camera. Which iPhone was that? I forget now.
The iPhone 4 had the first 5-megapixel camera, but I think it was the 4S with an 8-megapixel camera that everybody started talking about.
No, because I remember them talking a lot about the color saturation and that kind of thing in their camera, and I think...
Well, it was the 8-megapixel 4S camera that had the hybrid IR filter and the bigger camera sensor. I forget the name of that.
Yeah, so I feel like they're trying to do the same kind of thing here, where instead of playing the megapixels race, they're just trying to get better information out of the picture that is being taken. So
mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a little weird, but it probably will result in a better picture being taken.
I'm sure. So Nokia is the only one playing the megapixel race anymore, right? Because they're still releasing like 50 megapixel cameras.
They had that one 42 megapixel phone.
Right.
And by the way, the ultra pixel camera here is 4 megapixels, which does seem a bit low, doesn't it?
It does, but then they're not really focusing on megapixels, are they? They're focusing on ultra pixels.
That's right. So yet another marketing term that we'll have to weed out of the podcast, like 4G. I can't wait to get questions like, but how many ultra pixels does that have?
How many megapixels are in an ultra pixel?
And you'll have to say what, 4?
That seems low.
Yeah, definitely. Now, again, I'll say this again, and I keep saying this when we see these phones come out, but I think 4.7 is too big for most people in terms of the size of the screen.
Yeah, these Android phones keep getting bigger and bigger, and then the resolution is way higher than the human eye could possibly detect.
Yeah, they're playing the same game that Intel used to play, where they would bump the clock speed as high as they possibly could and still remain stable, just so that they could say that they've got the next, the next version of their chip with higher clock speed, and it really didn't make a lot of difference.
Right. And so, eventually, people stopped caring about clock speed.
Yeah, so I wonder if people are going to stop caring about 5.5-inch phones or whatever it is. This one happens to be 4.7, but I still think that's a little too big for most people. And I wonder when the industry is going to coil back upon that.
It's a good question. People start wanting smaller phones soon enough. Okay, the last thing I want to say about the HTC One, this is probably one of my favorite features about it, is that it has a built-in IR flashlight with its own app that makes the phone work as a universal remote for televisions.
That is pretty awesome. So you can have it learn infrared remote codes?
Well, hopefully the app can learn most of them for you.
Yeah.
And then you can come up with your own custom user interface. But I haven't used it, but I think it would be cool.
Yeah, that does sound cool. And last thing that we'll mention about the HTC One, the new HTC One, is it's beautiful. I really like the way this is designed.
Yeah, it looks almost exactly like an iPhone 5.
No, I don't know. It's substantially different.
I don't think it's substantially different.
But it's got a all metal body. I really like it. You'll have to go through to the show notes to have a look at the pictures that we'll put in there in the Android Central article here.
Yeah, it's an all metal body that's segmented at the bottom of the top, so it has antenna reception. Like, I don't know, the iPhone 5.
No, I think this is different. It's not as square. It's not as boxy.
It's not as chamfered.
Yeah, it's different. It's different. Anyway, go have a look in the show notes because there's only so much we can describe the pictures on the podcast. All right, our last top news story of the week. This one is very, very interesting. Canonical, the company that releases Ubuntu Linux, is releasing an Ubuntu specifically for tablets. And it looks quite interesting. What do you think?
It's hard to say exactly how it'll work. Especially because Ubuntu has changed their interface so many times, but they're obviously just going off what they've built from the desktop and their burgeoning smartphone software and applying that to a tablet. And I think that they have done a decent job of getting the broad strokes right. You know, using it will be another thing, but so far I think it looks pretty good.
It does look pretty good. And I like that they're creating something. In other words, they're taking a different spin on things, and I like that. But do you think any kind of mass market success could ever come of this? I don't think so.
No, probably not. But then Ubuntu has never gone for mass market success.
Yeah,
that's not
true.
Canonical's goal.
That's not the point. The point is to make something good.
Yeah, it's something good that people who want to use it can use it. And, if they can even get 2% of iPad users to switch from iOS to Ubuntu, if that's even possible. I'm sure it will be at some point in the future. Then that's probably a win for them.
Yeah, no, they're focusing on the Nexus devices. So the
Sure, because it would be easier to translate.
Right.
But, somewhere down the line, once Ubuntu for tablets is a real stable developed platform, they'll probably start working on a port for iPads, don't you think?
Yeah, I'd have to imagine so. Or at least somebody will. Maybe not Canonical, but somebody will work on doing that.
Right. We don't know a whole lot more about Ubuntu for tablets at this point. We do know that if you want to try it, you'll be able to download the preview code next week and install it on either a Nexus 7 or a Nexus 10.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting. They have a little demo of the UI, and it looks kind of interesting. It's kind of like they take the edge swiping from Windows 8 and mash it into a glassy type interface instead of the flatness that Windows 8 has. So I think that it looks really, really nice. I really like the way it's looking. Of course, you know, I don't know how the kind of flow of the interface works, but I like what they're doing.
Yeah, me too. It looks interesting.
Definitely.
I don't know if it will be or not.
Yeah, we'll keep our eye on it, I guess.
Right.
All right, so let's turn on the afterburners.
Okay, the Sony Xperia Tablet Z that we mentioned last month, it has got an official release at Mobile World Congress, and we found some more things about it. It's running Android 4.1 Jelly Bean. It is waterproof up to 3 feet, and it also is a TV remote control infrared blaster.
So Samsung is releasing some details about its HomeSync Android TV box, which seems to be some kind of Android-based Roku of some sort. And they'll say that it's going to sync with their smartphones with some AirPlay-style functionality. It has nothing to do with Google TV. It has everything to do with Android, and it'll be kind of interesting to see what they do with this thing.
Ah, so it's a Nexus Q.
Potentially.
I don't understand it at all. But the upstart Chinese mobile phone manufacturer Huawei has made some big leaps at Mobile World Congress this week. They have launched the Ascend P2, their new flagship 4.7-inch 720p Jelly Bean running Android phone. But it will have the strongest and fastest quad-core processor in any smartphone to date.
Yeah, Huawei has been upping their game recently, so it's interesting to see them come out with something for sure. So Nokia is also coming out with some new phones that run Windows Phone, the Nokia Lumia 520, which is going to get picked up by T-Mobile in the United States. And I have to assume that this is going to go into emerging markets as well, because it's a slightly lower-end device than the 920 and the 900 were. And we've also got the Nokia Lumia 720, and that's going to be $330. It's a slightly beefier version than the 520. And these are basically phones that I think were going to be targeted at the emerging market, and then T-Mobile happened to pick up the 520, is my take on it. So,
well, these prices are no contract prices, right?
Right.
I mean, you could just go, you know, if you manage to find a Lumia 520, you could just buy it for $180 or 139 euros in most of the places where they're going to sell it. And so that fits T-Mobile's new strategy in that they're getting rid of carrier subsidies for phones.
Yep. And they seem, I like the way they're designed is not too shabby. I think they look pretty nice for what they are. And at that price, you're right. That's a pretty interesting deal, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely a lower feature set. No front-facing camera on either of these, I think. You know, still Windows 8 phones, perfectly modern, perfectly capable.
No, so the slight correction, the 720 has a front-facing camera, but the lower-end 520 does not.
Aha, uh-huh. Excuse me. All right, so last week, Apple released a new update to iOS, that's 6.1.2. It fixes the exchange bugs and battery bugs. It does not break your jailbreak. If you jailbroke your iPhone, you can go ahead and update to this, and you don't have to worry about it too much. It does not fix the hack that lets you get through the lock screen password and access the phone's contacts and apps and other things.
Interesting.
Although Apple has already issued their second beta release of iOS 6.1.3, which will fix that gap and another security hole, which is the same thing. So there are two different ways now that have been discovered to get past the lock screen password in iOS 6.
So they,
which will be fixed whenever they come out with iOS 6.1.3.
They have to fix this. This is insane, right?
It's pretty insane. And the fact that they fixed it and then broke it three times already and then didn't fix it once everybody knew about it is a big problem. And so this next update should be coming hopefully very soon.
Yeah, so we'll see what happens. We'll talk about it when they do release an update, and so that you know that your iOS device is secure, because currently it's really not secure to put a pin on there. Anyways, in more happy news, Amazon and Ford have linked up to provide Amazon Cloud Player music to Ford cars via their App Link service. So you can use your Amazon Cloud Player music through your Android phone and control it from your steering wheel on select Ford cars. So that seems pretty cool. If you align with that ecosystem with Amazon, Android, and Ford, you've really got a pretty cool and compelling user experience in your car for playing all of your cloud music through your car and controlling it, through your phone and controlling it with your car. It's pretty cool.
Sounds fun. It almost makes me want to go out and buy a Ford and sign up for Amazon Prime.
And get an Android device?
Quite. Yeah, that too. Well, I wouldn't necessarily need an Android device except in the car, right?
Right. The music comes through the Android phone.
Right. It comes through the Android phone's data connection.
Right. Exactly right.
Gotcha. Okay. Hey, Chris, do you remember last week we were talking about Adobe and they had an exploit in their PDF software, and we told everyone that they should not use Adobe's PDF software?
Yes, of course. This happens.
Well, good news for Firefox users. Just go ahead and update to Firefox 19, the latest version, because it now has a built-in PDF reader that is not subject to Adobe's security vulnerabilities.
Yeah, and Chrome has done this for a long time. I think Safari has too, hasn't it?
Yeah, Safari's had it for many years.
So Firefox is joining the party. That's good to see.
Right. And Google Drive has come up with some updates as well. Now, from the website, you can preview photos, videos, documents, and PDF.
So a little feature, but definitely a nice one to have. I think... I'd have to look again, but I think SkyDrive has had this for a while.
Have they? Good for them. This is nice. I was using this week, and it was enjoyable.
Yeah, definitely good to have over on the Google Drive side of things. All right, with that...
And that's it for the afterburners.
Yes, let's turn off the afterburners, shut her down, and let's get into the end user stories. We've really only got a few of them here. The first one we've got is from The Verge, and it's Joshua Topolsky got to use Google Glass, which is very interesting looking. And what do you think of Google Glass? Do you think this is a reality, or are we fooling ourselves?
I don't know. It's really hard to say, because any video representation of Google Glass is inherently flawed.
Yeah, I could see that. That makes a lot of sense to me, because it's really about the experience of wearing the glasses, and it's really hard to convey what it feels like to actually wear the glasses. And I think The Verge and Joshua Topolsky, the writer of this article, does a really good job of trying to convey that. And it's a really good post, but it's just really hard. You really have to put these on your face and walk around.
Right. And considering that they're only available to Google employees and gadget writers and developers at the time, who happen to be extremely wealthy, and it will only a year from now be available to people who are extremely wealthy, and it has terrible battery life, and it only connects to your phone by Bluetooth, and there are only so many applications that can be developed when only a few really rich people are using it. It will be years before this is ubiquitous enough for people to understand it and then start working with it and creating new applications for it. In the meantime, if I saw anyone on the street wearing Google Glasses, I would definitely mess with them because it has always on voice recognition. And so why couldn't I just go up, like go right up to their face and then whisper something, and then all of a sudden they have to deal with all of the commands that I just gave them.
Yeah, I like that. You're a Google Glass hacker in that case. I like it.
Or just a Google Glass troll.
Yeah, yeah, more like a troll in real life kind of situation. Right. Now, I got to think that, I mean, it's just not going to be socially acceptable to wear these glasses anytime soon, right? This is not like Bluetooth, right? So people have a Bluetooth headset, and I think we have a grasp for what it means to have a Bluetooth headset, and you can see the little headset in their ear, but walking around with these glasses is a whole nother can of worms, and I'm not sure.
Actually, I don't think that's really true. People have gotten pretty used to Bluetooth headsets. No one thinks they look good or are cool, but people wear them and nobody says anything because here in America, at least, we live in a very free society, and the rule is you can do whatever you want. You can make yourself stupid or look stupid however you want. Nobody gets to say anything. So especially this picture of Mr. Topolsky here wearing the sunglasses version of Google Glasses, it doesn't actually look all that strange.
Yeah, the sunglasses
help a lot. Not compared to
a
Bluetooth headset.
The sunglasses do help a lot.
And I think that's going to be the way that most people will wear them for the near future.
I just think there's a limited use case for these things. I'm not sure. So I'm not sure that you would wear these things just kind of walking around, but I could definitely see a use case where, I don't know, you're riding a bicycle or something like that, and you get some useful heads-up information, like directions or something like this.
Yes, but then the temptation to get unuseful information when you're biking or driving is just so great.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure they're going to roll in Google Now-like content where they pop up information about what you're looking at and stuff like this.
Yeah,
and
Google Wallet information.
Right.
Do you want to go get a coffee here, get a burrito there?
Yeah, a contextual ad about what you're looking at is
bound ads. To happen. It's so going to be a problem.
I'm not sure we're ready, but I am glad that Google is dreaming about it.
Yes, me too.
I'm glad that they're experimenting. I will not call this silly, although I think it is kind of silly, but it's really good to see them attempt to innovate at something, and it's refreshing, I think.
Well, there's no way to know whether it's the right technology or the wrong technology until you try it.
Yeah, well, what's going to happen eventually is, they're going to have these glasses and they're going to do certain things. And eventually somebody's going to come along and do the iPhone thing, right? So we had smartphones for a long time before the iPhone rolled around. But then the iPhone came around and made the interaction with the phone so much simpler that it made sense to a market of people that smartphones previously did not make sense to. And I got to imagine that Google Glass is now in the phase of geeks are trying it out.
Well, I mean, geek royalty is trying it out.
Yeah, I guess so. So Rennie right. brings up in the chat room there, they're going to learn a lot from developing this product. And that's certainly true.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, that's Google's job as a company with a lot of money to blow. So our next story here has to do with copyright infringement and enforcement policy. The copyright alert system, which was finalized in 2011, will progressively warn and penalize alleged online copyright infringers. The way it basically works is most internet service providers in America will deal with copyright infringement notices essentially the same way they have been dealing with it before, but now you, the consumer, have 6 strikes. And after that, they will cut you off or have otherwise have dire consequences.
Yeah, so this is the new version of the 3 strikes that consumers vastly rejected and made a lot of noise about.
And their solution was 3 more strikes.
3 more strikes. This doesn't make it any better, right?
Yeah. So it's rolling out over the next few days to a week. But the thing to take home from this is that you basically have 6 strikes on alleged copyright infringement. You don't have to actually infringe a copyright. You just have to do something that makes a content owner think that you have done so. And file a notice to your internet service provider.
Right. So there's no due process involved in this. You get accused of copyright infringement six times, and then you have some kind of consequence. And it's worth noting on Verizon's end, they said they're not going to cut you off, but they are going to slow you down or have some other kind of consequence. So
yeah,
we've got AT&T, Verizon, Comcast, Cablevision, and Time Warner Cable are the participating ISPs. So there's not a lot of information out there. There's a lot of speculation. There's a lot of leaks that are happening, but it'll be interesting to see what they do.
Yeah, and this is going to affect a lot of people at some point down the road. So we are striving to know more, and we will inform you, the end user,
yes,
about all we learn.
All right, so with that, let's move into our green tech story of the week. Mr. Marr, what do you have for
us? One of my favorite parts of every week.
I think it's the favorite part.
This is a story from a few weeks ago, and you may have heard about it if you follow environment or green tech news, but 2012 was a landmark year for the American wind energy industry. There is, in fact, an American Wind Energy Association that announced that 40% of all new energy generating capacity in the U.S. was wind, so more than any other single energy sector. And in fact, that 40% is even more than the amount of wind production that was shut down in other forms of energy capacity. So we are on track to replace a great deal of our energy capacity with wind if this pace continues.
Yeah, and wind, particularly in the United States, because of the way this country is arranged, is particularly good for us, right? There's a lot of open space where you can put these things, and they're not going to bother a lot of people. We're not as dense a country as the entirety of Europe, right? So I think it makes a lot of sense for Americans to move to offloading at least some of their energy dependence to wind. That just makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and turbines are fairly easy to build if you already have large industrial manufacturing capacity, which we do. So 32 states and Puerto Rico had new wind developments come online in 2012.
And how many? We've got 13,000 megawatts in 2012 coming from...
Yeah, 13,000 megawatts of new capacity power. That is the equivalent of 15 million houses powered full-time.
Neat. All right. Well, thanks for the update on that. And let's get into you. You've got a tip of the week for us. What's up with this?
Okay, so I've read about, and we may have even shared a tip of the week before, about how to secure your computer using your webcam. The idea would be that it takes a picture of someone who is attempting to control your computer. But now there's an even easier way. There is a web app called MouseLog that all you have to do is go to the website, sign in with your Google account, and select a PIN number. After you set it, then whenever the mouse moves, you have to enter the PIN number or it takes a picture. And when it takes a picture, it will then email it to your Google account and tell you who it was that was trying to access your computer.
Or at least show you a picture of it.
Right.
Interesting. So that seems pretty good. I haven't seen anything quite like this before. I mean,
yeah,
we've seen versions of it. We talked about Prey, didn't we? I think we did.
Yeah, and there are versions of it that, as long as you're willing to install some software, do the whole setup thing correctly, and it's a little bit more robust, because not only will it use your webcam, take a picture, but it also is constant monitoring software that can tell you a lot more about who it is that maybe stole your computer and help you get it back. But this is just a really easy way to make sure that your computer is more secure when you walk away from it, and you have absolutely no setup. Like, anyone can do this right now as long as they have some sort of Google account.
Cool. Well, that's quite interesting. I'll have to play around with this, and we'll see how it works.
Yeah, so that is mouselock.co.
All right, so let's move on to our very last story, our kicker we've got an interesting one. I haven't seen anything quite like this before. What do you think?
Yeah, this was wild. This is a new prototype phone that is almost completely transparent. It's not really a phone because it can't make calls. It's just the form factor of a phone with a completely transparent screen. And the battery is not transparent. The SIM card is not transparent. The camera and speakers and a couple of wires are not transparent. But otherwise, I mean, the phone is just, it looks like a little piece of glass, and it has a working screen on it, which you can see in this little video. This was not at Mobile World Congress. This is a lab prototype by a Taiwanese company called Polytron Technologies.
Cool. And I'm not sure that the area that this kind of thing would take off in is a smartphone prototype, but I could see this technology applying in other fields more readily.
Right. Well, I've seen a lot of science fiction type stuff where, you know, 10, 20 years in the future, everybody has these phones that are just a blank piece of glass that has a screen pop up out of nowhere. And that's essentially what they've created here. And it's still in a very early prototype stage. It's difficult to even see the screen, but you can see it well enough in this video that the screen is functional and relatively high resolution. And so that's pretty cool. It's a piece of glass with a screen on it.
Yeah. Now we just need the imagination to figure out what to do with that. Maybe we can roll in Google Glass somehow.
I'm sure we can. Maybe this is the future of Google Glass.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe that's their. That'll lead to the iPhone moment that I was talking about. We'll see what happens with it. Cool stuff.
Might be, might not. But that's our kicker of this week. I thought it was extremely awesome, even though all they did was showing a single digit number on the screen.
Yeah, it's pretty early. It's definitely a very early prototype of just some base capability. Really cool, though. So, Taylor, if somebody were to try to contact you on Twitter, perhaps, how would they do so?
Well, Twitter would be a problem because it deletes tweets after a couple of weeks. I mean, you can archive them, but then, I mean, how would I see them years into the future? You know, I am, after all, a futurist. So that would be an issue. The best thing to do would probably be to call that special voicemail box from 12 Monkeys. And leave a message that I could get 30 years in the future, that would be the thing to do.
All right.
But if you want to access me now and you want to reach me on Twitter, I am at TaylorPhone.
All right. And if you wanted to get at me, I am at Chris Hale Barnes. So let us know what you think. We love to interact with people who are listening. So let us know what you think about the podcast and maybe how we can make it better. So that will do it for this week, a fun week with Mobile World Congress. Thank you, everyone, for listening to the show. You can find more information, including the show notes, at thedigitalmediazone.com under the end user. That's THENDUSR. The DMZ has a few other podcasts you can listen to. Listen to Entertainment 2.0, Scene in HD, and the Movie Podcast. You can send us some feedback, if you'd like, by tweeting us at the end user, or theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com is our email address. You can join us live in the chat room as we record the show every Monday night at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I am Futurist Prime, Taylor Moore.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye. We'll